Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it's been the worst day yet for the Dubai Ports World deal. The powerful and Republican-controlled House Appropriations Committee voted 62-2 yesterday. Did you even know there were 64 people on one committee? I guess it's because appropriations and everyone wants to be near the money. 62-2 yesterday to stop the takeover of a British ports company by Dubai Ports World. And the Financial Times reports today that other ports operations companies from other countries are now beginning to circle overhead, waiting for an opportunity that they now think might arise to take over this deal. And analyst and blogger Mickey Kaus, who's a prominent commentator on Slate.com, declares the deal dead, dead, dead. That's Kaus's headline today. Also dead, dead, dead might be the New York City Civilian Complaint Review Board. Now, this is a panel that some of you may remember was fought for hard in the 80s and 90s to provide civilian oversight of alleged police brutality cases. The New York Civil Liberties Union says the board's new findings on police activities during the Republican National Convention in New York in 2004 show how toothless it is. So we will talk about both these stories now with WNYC's Bob Henley, who's been covering both. And Chris Dunn of the New York Civil Liberties Union is also with us to talk about the CCRB, the Civilian Complaint Review Board. We invited the NYPD spokesman, Paul Brown, but he hasn't gotten back. Chris Dunn from the New York Civil Liberties Union, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian, and good morning.
Bob Henley, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And let's review a little bit. Here is a clip from an interview I did with the mayor at the Republican convention. We were inside Madison Square Garden about reports that morning, I think it was the Wednesday morning of that week, that the police were rounding up peaceful protesters to get them off the streets. The protesters were confronted by a line of police officers who told demonstrators they were blocking the sidewalk and would be arrested, although they did not appear to be blocking pedestrian traffic at that point.
Look, the police have to be there, make a decision, and let people go through. The police make their decisions, and the courts can then decide whether the police were right.
Mayor Bloomberg responding to some lines from the New York Times that I was reading to him about that previous evening. Now, here's another clip. This is from a video taken of police and demonstrators during a big demonstration in Lower Manhattan. First, the police appear to give the marchers permission to walk, even though they didn't have a permit. Listen.
You have to comply. Wait, listen to me. Are you going to listen or no? You have to comply.
Right, just be patient.
When you're walking through the streets.
That's
so
it.
When there's a red light, you have to stop.
So the officer there saying you have to comply with the rules of traffic. If you want to march, if there's a red light, you have to stop. But just a few minutes later, here's an order to arrest them all. Listen carefully. It's short.
Everyone here is under arrest.
Everyone here is under arrest. Now, Bob Henley, the Civilian Complaint Review Board. Tell us what it is.
Well, in 1993, after a lot of lobbying and campaigning by advocates who wanted the police department to be accountable under civilian control, the board got this independence. Prior to that, it had been under the police department. And what we see now is a situation where this event that happened in, I guess, gosh, it's got to be 2004. It was August, September. It's taken quite a while for it to be adjudicated. On average, it takes, I guess, Chris, you know this better than I, 8 to 9 months for cases to go through. In this case now, after the statute of limitations has phased out on these kinds of complaints, we finally hear, without very much detail, that three charges have been substantiated against a sergeant, a lieutenant, and a deputy chief of department.
Chris Dunn from the New York Civil Liberties Union, explain to the best of your understanding what exactly was released by the CCRB yesterday. What's new here?
Well, what's new is that the CCRB finally announced the results of the investigations that it conducted into complaints it received about police misconduct during the convention. But as Bob indicated, the information they released was quite incomplete, and the glaring omission is an explanation as to why now, 18 months after the fact, are they only now completing investigations. Indeed, yesterday morning before the public meeting, they were in executive session completing 7 investigations, all, I believe, involving high-level department officials, including chiefs. Even though the time for even theoretically imposing any discipline on police officers ran out at the end of February, over a week ago. And what is behind all this, and what the CCRB refuses to talk about, and which is the most troubling aspect of this, is that the police department was able to completely stonewall the CCRB by refusing to produce for interviews high-level officials who were the subjects of complaints about the convention. And what that meant was, if the CCRB could not interview the official who was charged with misconduct, the CCRB could not complete its investigation, and therefore it could not forward any proposed discipline to the police department because the investigation has to be done first. And as a result of all this, what the police department was able to do was to insulate its officers from any potential discipline by simply running out the clock, and they did it.
Now, the New York Times story on this notes that the CCRB did bring complaints against 3 individual members of the NYPD, but it says the board was unable to reach a consensus on the behavior of other chiefs who ordered mass arrests, and it made no public findings on complaints against them. I want to play another clip. This is of the NYPD spokesman, Deputy Commissioner Paul Brown, who was on the show last July, and I asked him about that particular incident that we had audio of, where first the police seemed to give the demonstrators permission to walk if they complied with traffic rules, and then they placed them all under arrest. So when I asked Commissioner Brown about that, here's what he said.
Okay. What happened is there was an agreement ahead. The group wanted to march. This was a group that had planned to march the convention, I think stage a die-in somewhere further uptown. They wanted to begin by walking. They had no permit, so this was negotiated on the spot. They actually had no legal right to do that. I mean, you can't just take a city street or sidewalk without and put other people in jeopardy by forcing them into the street, for example, if you're taking up the sidewalk, unless you make arrangements with the police. Despite not having made those arrangements, we were negotiating with them on the spot to accommodate it. One agreement was they were going to carry their banner instead of out front and forcing other pedestrians off the sidewalk. They would carry it at their side. As they walked about a few blocks towards Broadway, the people at the front took the whole sidewalk, began putting the banner out fully, and essentially violated the agreement that had just been worked out, and the commanding officer ordered the arrest. What you saw was the tail end of that, and you know, I'll admit that maybe the individuals at the tail of it hadn't heard it. That played in the reason to vacate that arrest.
And the charges later were dropped against all the protesters involved in that. That was Deputy Police Commissioner Paul Brown on this program last July. So Bob Henley, there are conflicting accounts of what happened. Do we necessarily say that the Civilian Complaint Review Board is dead and toothless and controlled by the police because they weren't able to come to a definitive finding of wrongdoing here?
Well, because Commissioner Brown is not on, I do feel obligated to relay what he has said to me, which is that they feel that the New York Civil Liberties Union has tried to use this process to put on trial the policies, not the individual behavior of command officers. Now, as my colleague Jim Dwyer mentions in the Times, say this was an unusual event in that we saw, with 10,000 officers out in the street, a number of high-ranking people that normally don't have a street presence out on the street. So, but that's the department's point of view, is that, listen, we had 10,000 officers. They substantiated complaints against 3. We'll take it. There were hundreds of thousands of demonstrators and very few injuries. In fact, the one injury that was, they'll say, was the police officer who was hurt. So that's their approach. They'll say, you know, take a look at what happened in 2000, Los Angeles and Philadelphia. I was in those places, and those were rolling riots with tear gas and rubber bullets.
So, Chris Dunn, what conclusion do you come to about the overall performance of the NYPD? You just heard what Bob said.
Well, we have said from the outset that we felt that the department actually did many good things during the convention, and we acknowledge that, and we support the department in that respect. Having said that, there's no doubt there were significant mistakes that were made, and the thing that we have found to be so difficult to deal with is that the police department has from the outset taken the position that its performance during the convention was flawless, that it made no mistakes, and that anyone criticizing it has some sort of devious agenda. And I will simply point out, the facts that bear on that is that there were approximately 1,800 people who got arrested. Over 90% of those cases were dismissed. We have a number of large-scale mass arrests where there is videotape that makes it quite clear that the arrests were improper. And the Fulton Street episode that you were describing is the best example, where we have 227 people who were arrested, put in handcuffs, sat in Pier 57, were held for as long as 3 days, and then the district attorney's office dismissed all the cases upon reviewing tape and concluding that those people had not engaged in any unlawful activity. And it is our position that while the department did many good things during the convention, when hundreds of people are arrested and held for days without having done anything unlawful, that's a serious concern, and the police department, if it's being responsible, should address that.
Chris Dunn from the New York Civil Liberties Union with me on WNYC, along with WNYC's Bob Henley, as we talk about this new report from the Civilian Complaint Review Board about police activities during the Republican convention. And we'll go on in a few minutes to talk about the worst day yet for the Dubai Ports World deal, which Bob is also covering. And we can take your phone calls on either of these stories at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Bob?
One of the things also is to keep in mind that the city did have a situation where they had to pay out over $250,000 because itself was cited for criminal contempt for holding individuals, hundreds of individuals, who had been ordered released by a judge, and they kept in jail. So eventually, without admitting any wrongdoing, the city cut a check. I think it was like $106, maybe like a good weekend in New York, on behalf of these protesters. There is a certain pattern here, though, in terms of the department's ability to publicly learn, if you will. This is not the first time there's been a dust-up about information sharing. There was a whole thing over the Commission to Combat Police Corruption, which is another city agency where the chairman stepped down over having trouble getting information from Kelly. There's never the allegation of corruption. It's more a problem of arrogance and control of information. That's what I'm hearing.
And Chris Dunn, how do you put this in context from your perspective at the New York Civil Liberties Union of the performance of the CCRB overall? I mean, I remember, we were covering on this show all the debates, pro and con at the time in the 90s, about whether there should be some kind of civilian oversight of the police or whether that would hamstring them from doing their jobs. So it's been over a decade. Are they toothless in general or just in this case, in your opinion?
Well, I'll tell you, Brian, our concern has been that over the last several years in particular, the ability of the CCRB to exercise independent oversight has just diminished rapidly. And I think that most people recognize, and maybe not Commissioner Kelly, but most people recognize that civilian oversight is good not only for residents in New York City, but it's good for the police department. It is good to have an outside check. When you have a king, that is not good for anyone. And what has happened, and it's been illustrated by the convention, is the police department has shown that it can take steps that will guarantee that civilian oversight is meaningless. Here, the police department just said, we're not going to produce people for interviews. And if they can do it for an event as high profile as the Republican National Convention, it's our concern they can do it for anything.
Which raises a question which we'll try to answer after the break. Does the CCRB have subpoena power? And if not, is there a way they can get it? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we continue to talk about the Civilian Complaint Review Board findings on police activities during the Republican National Convention. Largely, it's a lack of findings. We'll also talk about the Dubai Ports World deal in a couple of minutes. Bob Henley, WNYC News, has been covering both stories. Also with us, Chris Dunn from the New York Civil Liberties Union, which declares the Civilian Complaint Review Board toothless and dead for all practical purposes after this. Alan in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alan.
Yeah. Hi. A question or comment. My question was, Does the CCRB not have any kind of subpoena power, or is it just an entirely voluntary process where anybody under investigation can come in as they wish? And my own personal experience, I'm a civil attorney, and sometimes I have civil matters involving cases against the police department, and we generally, in those kinds of situations, let other investigations take precedence. My experience is that CCRB hearings and results can take 3 or 4 years.
Chris Dunn?
Well, in fact, the city charter provisions that created the CCRB impose an express legal obligation on the police department to produce officers for interviews. And the reason why the police department ultimately relented in December on its policy of not producing officers is that the law department told them they had to. So there is a legal obligation. This policy of not producing officers was not only thwarting the investigations, but it was completely illegal.
So how could that be enforced?
Well, that's a complicated thing. The CCRB, I believe, could have enforced it. The CCRB, as I understand it, does have subpoena authority, but it is quite clear the CCRB is not about to confront the police department on this issue. They would not speak about it publicly. It is inconceivable that they would proceed with legal action.
The one thing, though, it does appear that the CCRB is going to continue to investigate and come up with a report that looks at some of the incoherence that was going on that you documented here, Brian, in terms of when you have mass events and the police give orders, how much time is the public given, and how much situational awareness does the department really have on who's involved? Because one of the things we've seen, the worst cases here, are individuals just going about their lives, just trying to make a living in the city, which is tough enough, got scooped up and lost days because of some kind of desire to have maximum Uber control of the streets.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another phone call, this time from someone who says they filed a complaint with the CCRB and wants to talk about their experience. Steve in Manhattan. Hi, Steve. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
This goes back a few years. This goes back to 1996. Actually, you'll certainly remember when the Yankees won the World Series, and there were celebrations in Times Square, and I was inadvertently swept up and beaten up by a couple of cops, including a police chief, a white shirt. And I filed a complaint with the CCRB. I had a colleague of mine, I was a New York Times photographer, a colleague of mine was there on the site, and he took photographs. And we submitted all this to the CCRB, and my case was dismissed for two reasons. One was that the officer was unidentified, even though I had his name, his rank, his precinct, and we had photographs.
So what does that mean to them, that he was unidentified, you had his name and so forth?
What they said, what I did is I followed up and I appealed, and I ended up having discussions with Gene Lopez, who back then was the head of the CCRB. He said that when they talked to this chief and they talked to the various officers who were involved, all of them denied any role in this. They denied even being there. They denied. And he said that was all we could do. At that point, we couldn't substantiate that it was even them. And therefore, they had to dismiss the case. And I asked further, was there no subpoena power? Was there no ability to pursue this with a little bit more heat? And he said, no, absolutely not. He said that they really did not have teeth. They relied completely upon the cooperation of the officers involved, and without that, they had nothing more they could do. They said had there been substantial physical injuries, they would have had more leeway.
More evidence,
possibly. But then they could have pursued it in a different avenue, because I did not carry my scars, and the officers just denied it, even though we had photographs. And I asked him, I said, with photographs, you tell me you can't identify this person.
And they said what?
And they said, this is the verbiage that we use when we don't have an absolute agreement from the officer that, in fact, he was involved.
Bob?
Well, and in fact, 7 of the 63 complaints that finally were put through the CCRB process, that's exactly what was the final conclusion, was that the officer couldn't be identified. I think one of the things, too, if you look at the Handy Green book, you'll see how maybe structurally the deck might be stacked. I mean, 5 members are selected by the mayor out of the 13, and 3 members are designated by the police commissioner. And those the police commissioner's designees are the only members permitted to have law enforcement backgrounds. So you don't get a chance for a cross-pollination here. I mean, one of the things that I think they might consider doing is, you know, we know there's an internal affairs process and that any organization that's got 34, 37,000 individuals is going to have problems. And they'll say that they police those problems and do it effectively. To add to transparency, it would be great, in addition to the fantastic crime statistics, and no one takes that away from the current commissioner. That's happening. They're reducing crime to historic levels. And this police administration seems to have some awareness of the diversity of the city that prior administrations haven't had. But why not put on a website with all these other great statistics, the internal affairs numbers? Not the names, but just this is how many investigations were concluded. This is how many people got disciplined, to give people some sense of accountability. And I think that's the kind of thing that would be moving in the right direction.
All right. We're going to move on to the Dubai story. So Chris Dunn from the New York Civil Liberties Union, thank you very much for coming on with us today.
Thank you for having me on,
Chris.
Brian.
And coming up in about 10 or 15 minutes, we will have a spokesman for the Prime Minister of Iraq, George Saada. And there's obviously a lot to talk about with him. He also has a new book that claims Saddam Hussein stashed weapons of mass destruction in Syria before the war. So this is going to be an interesting interview with George Saada coming up in about 10 minutes. But right now to Dubai Ports World, which you may know WNYC's Bob Henley has been on since it really, before it broke as a big national story. Bob, the vote yesterday in the House Appropriations Committee, very powerful committee, obviously, because they control the purse strings, 62-2 to stop this deal in some way, shape, or form. What exactly did they vote to do?
What they did was they attached to the appropriations bill that's going to provide military aid to Iraq and Afghanistan to keep the troops deployed forwardly. And then also what it would do is not permit them, DPW, to take over these U.S. operations. And, I mean, when you see Congressman Rodney Frelinghuysen, who is a Republican from New Jersey, siding with, I guess it was Congressman Lewis, who was running this up the flagpole, you really see that this is not abating. I don't know, what do you call the dish that's a roasted lame duck? Because that's what the situation that President Bush is in on. Now, the only salvation for him right now is that in the Senate, apparently the Senate leadership, that would be Senator Frist, is reluctant to join in and bring this to a vote on the floor in the Senate. So for now, we hang in this limbo of the 45-day, second round of the investigation that was supposed to occur. Now, meanwhile, while this is happening, the New York Times had a great story this morning about the disclosure by the Homeland Security Office that at least half of the Jersey drivers who are driving trucks into the port complex have criminal records.
Yes, ABC News had that first yesterday. What does that mean, and does it have anything to do with the Dubai Ports World deal?
Well, what it shows is that over the last 4 years, there has been tremendous resistance to getting a unified card that you could use if you were in the maritime business. So you could go from port to port or job to job, and there would be some kind of unified database in terms of your background, license, and your criminal background. So, I mean, this just gives you a sense of how little we've done in terms of dealing with port security. And so this mixes together with the optics of the Dubai Ports World deal to really show the administration, you know, on the losing end of this.
But explain something to me. If this bill passes all of Congress, does it cancel the deal? Does the U.S.
No.
government have the power when a Dubai company buys a British company?
Listen, in the 21st century, we're going to find out just how little power the United States has. That's going to be an ongoing theme here. But I think what happens is that the part of the deal that has to do with the six U.S. ports, and I think there's been some reporting that there's even other facilities in the United States that DPW would have, you know, some control over, those will not be able to be taken over. The leases will not be able to shift to P&O. That, as far as the P&O deal, the larger $6 billion plus deal, the ship has sailed on that, and there was a closing March 1st, and that egg can't be unscrambled.
Bob Henley, WNYC News, my guest, and we can take some phone calls on the Dubai Ports World deal for the next few minutes, 212-433-WNYC. anyone involved with ports, particularly welcome to call. Anyone whose opinions about this are evolving as you learn more information, 212-433-9692. And let's take a phone call from Bob in Forest Hills. Hi, Bob.
How you doing, sir? How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Good, good. I spent 5 years working in the maritime industry,
mm-hmm.
four of which was in port operations, actually right near where all these problems are happening.
In Port Newark?
Yes, actually in Port Newark.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of talk, and I hear a lot of misinformation just because people don't really know everything there is in the maritime industry, one of which you just mentioned were these cards. Anyone that works in the Port of New York as a longshoreman, a checker, a handler, have to get approved by the New York Shipping Association, including the non-union workers that are called stevedores or superintendents. And they go through a background check. I went through it myself, where you get questioned through the New York Shipping Association, that you get your fingerprints taken. So there is a lot of security. And even if you do have a criminal record, at that point they have you in a database with a criminal record. The problem with the truckers are, the truckers aren't maritime workers. They're just Joe Blow that some ship freight forwarder hires to come in and pick up their cargo. They really have no say in the port operations other than picking up and dropping off.
So with your experience, how concerned are you that Dubai Ports World ownership would be any more security risk than the current ownership?
I have one concern. I was actually telling your screener.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to a ship coming in, you know, tying up and setting up cargo operations, it goes through the same procedure that U.S. flagships go through. What happens, in my concern, is when you have Dubai Ports World working there, you can have a port captain from Dubai that lives in the United Arab Emirates, is an employee of this company, come to America to work these ships as a specialist with less scrutiny through work visas and stuff like that than, you know, if you came through normal immigration patterns. Because when I worked at my company, I have to be a foreign company, I'm not going to mention any names, mm-hmm. or countries or whatever,
right.
They had people that, you know, worked in the mother country, so to speak. They came to work on ships regularly in the United States, and they passed in and out with roughly no problem.
Bob, that's really interesting. Thank you very much for calling.
Well, that's a really nuts and bolts example of the kind of interfaces that need to be secured.
The Financial Times is reporting today that other companies now are starting to circle for the possibility that this deal, and actually my understanding is that it was supposed to close on March 1st, but didn't, and that closing has actually been delayed. And if that's the case, or even if they did close, is there a possibility that some other company could now swoop down and take over the deal, take over the purchase, because it's running into so much political heat in the United States? That seems to be what the FT is reporting that some companies are setting themselves up to do.
Well, and they may also be the other government-owned port companies, because remember, the other bidder in the in this battle for P&O was the Port of Singapore state-owned logistics maritime company. One of the things that I would wonder about is the House of Cards here. You had a really good guest on around this issue who had some financial expertise and talked about how seriously leveraged this deal was. So I wonder if they don't put themselves, Dubai Port World doesn't put themselves in, you know, some serious trouble here, because it takes, you know, holding that much capital in place is costly. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not this whole thing comes apart. I mean, that's from my standpoint, they've always represented that they were moving ahead with the transaction, but suspending the U.S. portion of it. That's what they've been reported stateside.
Gibbs in Manhattan is cynical about the 62-2 vote. Hi, Gibbs.
I don't believe that 62-2 vote for a second.
But what don't you believe about it?
Well, it seems to me that the Republicans who own the shipyards would seemingly have done something in the last 3-4 years, and suddenly they're all rallying around patriotism or guardedness. Seems to me they can all very nicely vote against this thing, and the president can veto it without anybody being the worst for it.
And the president certainly has threatened to veto it, but Bob, that doesn't let them off the hook. 62-2 is enough to override if that ratio holds.
Right.
So then the pressure.
The caller's a great point, though. There's no doubt that, I mean, we've spent some $28, $25 billion on airline security, and I don't think, you know, like some $800 million on port security. These issues have been on the table for a long time, and the industrial interests have been really running the regulatory show here. And, I mean, even you have this mid-level report coming out of Homeland Security today about what's going on with the truckers having access to the port. This is not rocket science. They've known this for a while.
Khaldun in Montclair. You're on WNYC. Hi, Khaldun.
Good. How you doing?
Okay.
Well, the reason I'm calling, I'm an Arab American, and I happen to be one of those very progressive Arabs who eventually got fed up with a dictatorship in my country, and I left. I'm a physician. I'm a practicing physician. I'm an American citizen now, and my kids are American citizens. And all this reaction against this United Arab Emirates company, it's kind of, first of all, the Arab American in the United States, they're going to think, well, it doesn't matter how American we become, they will never be considered as American. It's the next thing is going to be just witch hunting against Arab businesses.
So, Calvin, let me throw at you what people on the other side say and get your reaction. They say this is not anti-Arabism. This is skepticism of the government of Dubai, which had an open banking system that enabled financing for the 9/11 terrorists, that from which two of the terrorists came, that recognized the Taliban even for a while after 9/11, and that has been known to kind of play both sides with respect to Al-Qaeda-U.S. relations. Can they, as a specific entity, be trusted? That's the question that people are raising. Is that anti-Arab?
Well, let me tell you this, like the relationship with the Taliban, the U.S. government had a relationship with the Taliban, and in fact, everybody in the Arab world knows, like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan when they were fighting the Russians,
right,
they were directly or indirectly.
Well, they were the precursors of the Taliban, and the UAE was one of just three countries to actually recognize that government.
Well, it's, I think they recognize them on an Islamic basis, and if there are two terrorists in a UAE, that doesn't include the whole population and
right,
the whole businesses in there. And don't, like, we have terrorists here in the United States, and it's like we have terrorists everywhere. So two people from the UAE, that doesn't incriminate the whole country.
Khaldun, it's an important call and an important part of the dialogue that obviously will continue around this issue. Bob Henley, we have 30 seconds left before we go to George Sada, spokesman for the Iraqi Prime Minister. Congressman Peter King from Long Island is starting to talk about a compromise. He's been one of the biggest opponents of the deal, a compromise under which a U.S. subsidiary would actually run and have control over these port operations in the United States. You think that's the basis of a deal?
I think that may have been yesterday's news. I think the train has moved so far past that. They sense blood in the water, and they're moving in. As a caller said before, one of the significant casualties of this has been Arab-American relationships, and I think that goes back to how Bush has handled it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC thanking Bob Henley on WNYC. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Coming up, George Sada, a spokesman for the Iraqi Prime Minister, and also a former general in Saddam's Air Force who now claims that weapons of mass destruction were shipped to Syria before the war. Stay tuned.